death will leave you standing and crying in this land.
Once again, this is Bob Young talking with James DiEugenio about The Assassinations, his new book from Feral Press.
Feral House,
right. Which is a fairly new publishing house here in Los Angeles.
It's been around for a few years, and it does basically, you know, counterculture and offbeat, you know, kind of books. I knew Random House was not going to touch this book, especially after you did Gerald Posner's book.
Well, yeah, Bob Loomis and the like.
Yeah,
yes,
right,
we won't
right.
get into that immediately. We may talk about that before the end of this, however. Lee Harvey Oswald is wandering about the world with apparently two entirely separate bodies. And
two identities, yes.
Here's an interesting point that isn't really mentioned in Armstrong's articles, but I thought it might be a good idea to ask you. Why didn't Marina tumble to this, Marina Oswald, who was in fact married to him? Which was she married to, and did she realize that there was another Lee wandering around?
Harvey. She is married to the Harvey guy.
Right.
All right. And there is a little incident in the book where she goes to see Oswald in the funeral parlor and has somebody raise his eyes, okay, and she whispers, you know, they'll never know who the real Oswald really was, or
that's
something to that effect.
That's a chilling moment.
Yeah. Right. You know, so Marina, this is interesting also, because I think if you count the times that they met prior to them getting married, I think it was four times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, four times. You know, and suddenly they're married, and then you get the odd coincidence that Marina, of course, was the niece of an NKVD officer, which I think is sort of the equivalent of the Secret Service, you know, in the United States. KGB would be the CIA, and
right.
the NKVD would be this kind of Secret Service, you know, in America, all right? And then, of course, they go to Minsk, all right? And then in one of the most extraordinary aspects of the whole tale of Lee Harvey Oswald, they're lent money by Health, Education, and Welfare to come back into the United States. Now, let's put this in context. This is 1962, all right? The missile crisis, the closest
yeah.
that America has ever come to nuclear war, it's right about the same time period,
mm-hmm.
all right? And so this defector who has gone over and promised to give secrets away to the Russians, which could have come in very handy if we would have gone to nuclear war, with the communists over Cuba in the missile crisis, because he had secrets of radar and how to track missiles, you know, and things
well,
like
when,
that.
When Lee was stationed in Okinawa, he, of course, worked on the U-2 project.
Right.
And the U-2 project was, even though they had managed to shoot down one by that point, Francis
mm-hmm.
Gary Powers in the
yeah.
1959 incident, the U-2 was still highly
yeah.
classified.
It was the keystone of our intelligence.
And most important, Lee knew the altitudes
right.
at which the U-2 flew.
Correct. Now, imagine us lending money to this guy
mm-hmm.
so he can come back into the United States. Now, everybody knows things like the Walker incident, with what happened when we found out, you know, that Walker was selling secrets. I mean, these guys go to prison, you know, Aldrich Ames, et cetera. These guys go to prison for decades. They sometimes never see the light of day again.
In fact, Jonathan Pollard just asked for another review of his case and was turned down. So,
right.
yeah.
But Oswald gets back into the country, no questions, and we actually lend the money to get back in here. And then for years and years and years, the CIA insisted that they, and this is really unbelievable, the CIA insisted they didn't even debrief him when he came back into this country. Now imagine this. Here is a guy who's threatened to, like, sell secrets to the Russians, all right? And then we don't even bother to even talk to him before he comes back into the country. John Newman found a couple of pieces of paper, which probably are the actual debriefings
huh.
of Oswald when he comes back into the United States, all right? And this was in the declassified files in 19. I guess I should talk about that a little, how the book came about and how I know we know this stuff
definitely,
today.
Definitely, definitely.
Because after JFK came out,
the Oliver Stone film.
Oliver Stone's film in 1991 and 1992, it created such a sensational uproar. Right, because this is the first time that the general American public is really being exposed to the incredible circumstances and facts surrounding what happened to President Kennedy. For the most part, a lot of them, you know, a book that sells 100,000 copies, we call a bestseller. Well, tens of millions of people actually saw this picture, all right? So, and they were kind of stunned at this. And then, of course, at the end of the film, there's that title card where Oliver said that the files of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the last investigation of President Kennedy's murder, are classified till the year 2039. Well, obviously, you do some math and you figure out, well, that's funny because none of us are going to be alive to see those documents when they do get declassified. Mm-hmm. So what's so secret? All right, so finally, Congress was embarrassed. Actually, Lewis Stokes, the guy who was the chairman of that committee, went to see the movie with his daughter. And on the way home, the daughter said, Dad, why did you do that? Why did you classify those files, you know, for the next 50 years, you know? And so, and this happened to all these people, Arlen Specter, all these people were finally, you know, like badgered into finally saying, okay, all right, all right. And so they declassified these files from 1994 to 1998. And that is basically what our book is based upon, what the government knew but didn't want to tell the American public. And now, if you pick up the book and read it, now you know why.
Yes.
Now you know why they didn't want us to know, for very good reason. If I was them, I wouldn't want us to know either.
No.
But to give you an example of how arrogant, I talked to John Tonheim, who was the chairman of the committee, the ARRB, which declassified the files. And there was a CIA liaison, you know, see, and the public doesn't know this either. See, whenever the FBI or the CIA have to give up documents, they have what they call a liaison officer with who they're giving it up to. And they never want to give you everything. You know, if they can't keep the whole document away from you, they'll at least say, well, for reasons of national security, that's the mantra for everything. For reasons of national security, let's black out this, 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 and this. So you might get a document that says something like at the top, the investigation of, then everything else is blacked out, and at the very end it says, of Lee Harvey Oswald. All right, and then they call that a declassified document.
Gee, sounds like the Lopez report.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah, which I hope we can talk about later.
Yes, definitely.
All right, and so, so finally, the CIA comes in with their documents to the ARRB, and they have an overhead projector there. They put it on a screen, and Tonheim looks at the document, which he thinks is pretty innocuous, and he looks at it, and he tells the CIA officer, what on earth would want you to keep that secret for the next 40 years? There's nothing possibly in there that could endanger anything. So the CIA guy looks at Tonheim, give me a couple of minutes and I'll think of something. That's a true story. And that's what the kind of stuff these guys get away with, you know, every day in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, this the ARB, because it reversed the weight of the evidence. Instead of you going to court and having to prove that these documents should be declassified, which unbelievably is the standard today, the CIA had to prove themselves why it should not be. And so most of the time, almost all the time, they lost because there simply is no mantra of national security for almost all these documents. The things they get away with in the name of national security, like Jim Garrison said in his Playboy interview, I mean, it's pretty much amounts to, you know, their blank check for giving away only what they want to give away, you know, and leaving us in the dark about everything else.
A friend of mine who has done a fair amount of research over the years said it's very much like trying to steal internal organs from a heavily armed donor.
Correct.
You know,
correct.
They fight tooth and nail over every document they have.
And like I said, it's not because what's in them. It's simply because they want to be the ultimate arbiter of what gets out and what does not get out.
Also, of course, and this was a problem that I think the country had with J. Edgar Hoover, is the fact that these people are very territorial, and they absolutely have to fight every year for funding.
Right.
And it tends to make them paranoid, creepy, weird, and very hard to get along
with.
Correct.
To give you another example, you mentioned the Lopez Report.
Mm-hmm.
The Lopez Report was the report done by Eddie Lopez and Dan Hardway, two law students, for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. They had unbelievable access to files okay, that nobody had ever seen before. They actually, you know, saw documents, interviewed people that nobody had ever done before in their research on Oswald's trip to Mexico City, which I hope we get to talk about, because in my opinion, that's probably the most important essay in the whole book, John Newman's analysis of what really happened in Mexico City. All right, now, this report was something like 340 pages, not including the footnotes. All right, so when the House Select Committee had closed down shop and the report was finished, the CIA guys come in, and with Robert Blakey, the chief counsel, Eddie Lopez, and Dan Hardway, they start going through the report page by page to see what is going to be classified and what is going to be declassified. When I interviewed Eddie up at his house in Rochester, New York, Jim, I'm not kidding you, it took us 8 hours to get through the first page. And he goes, they argued over every sentence on that first page.
Good Lord. So
after the end of the first day, Blakey just basically threw in the towel, because you figure it out. We're going to be there a year.
Yeah.
You know, figure out what's going to be classified and what's going to be declassified. And so the whole report was classified until the Stone movie came out.
This is certainly a collection of documents that brings into serious question what was going on in the weeks prior to the assassination.
Right.
Lee Oswald is rumored, I believe, in late September, was it? Or early October of 63, to have gotten on a bus.
It's late September.
Late September.
The last few days of September.
Gotten on a bus, sat down next to a man who just happened to have really deep CIA connections. But, of course, this has absolutely nothing to do with the case.
Right.
Drove to Mexico on this bus, went to the Cuban consulate, or called the Cuban consulate first, which is kind of interesting. He talked to somebody for a while there in a consulate that was not open.
And, yeah, this whole, to give you the background on this, the Warren Commission tells us that in the last week of September, Marina Oswald left with Ruth Payne and went back to Dallas, right? Oswald stayed a few days behind.
In New Orleans, yeah.
In New Orleans, and was supposed to have left either the 24th or the early morning of the 25th, all right? But he doesn't go to Dallas. And instead, you know, he takes a trip down to Mexico. Now, as an interesting sidelight, it's this very same period of time that Sylvie Odio reports that a guy named Oswald and two Cubans show up at her door in Dallas.
Now, Sylvie Odio was?
Sylvie Odio was a kind of liberal Cuban exile who worked in the exile community in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, whose father was exiled by Castro to the Isle of Pines off the coast of Cuba. All right, and she said that these two Cubans came to her door, and with a guy they called Oswald,
okay? Leon Oswald. Yeah.
All right, and they then called her the next day or the day after, and said that Leon Oswald, you know, is crazy. You know, he actually wants to shoot Castro. All right, and then of course when the Kennedy assassination happens, she's watching TV, and she looks up, and she sees this picture, and it resembles almost identically this Oswald guy, and she literally fainted, all right? Now, this is very strong evidence, okay, that somehow somebody was setting Oswald up, you know, in advance of the assassination. The Warren Commission dismissed it, and you know why? One of the reasons they dismissed it. They said, well, he couldn't have been there because he was in Mexico City. Now, this gets very interesting as we go through Mexico City, because as we'll find out, it's very seriously questioned whether Oswald was in Mexico City at all.
That's
at this
true.
Time.
And that was, of course, the gist of the Lopez report.
Right.
We will get to that in just a moment. We're going to take a short break here. My name is Bob Young, and I'm talking with James DiEugenio, the author of, or the editor, rather, of The Assassinations, Probe Magazine on JFK, MLK, RFK, and Malcolm
X. I'm sure that they'll edit this out.
In just a moment.
Where they'll let it out, Country Joe and the Fish is good things, and, you know, some things, but I want to say it anyway, even though they will edit it out. When President Kennedy was killed, he was not killed by one man. He was shot from a number of different directions by different guns. The story has been suppressed. Witnesses have been killed. And this is your country, ladies and gentlemen.